Today on Against the Grain, is it possible to eat animal products ethically, as proponents of small-scale animal agriculture advocate? Or, as critical theorist John Sambamatsu argues, is consuming animals unjustifiable, not just for reasons of disease and the climate emergency, but also because of the emotional complexity and intelligence of non-human animals? Sambamatsu makes the case for opposing and abolishing the animal economy in tandem with capitalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Michael Pollan's best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, which was published in 2006, made the argument that one could reject the horrors of the factory farming of animals while still eating meat. John Sambamatsu, professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, says that couldn't be further from the truth. In his book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves, Sambamatsu argues that the notion of ethical meat consumption hides the realities of killing and eating animals. He's also the author of The Postmodern Prince. John, over the last several decades, there's been a renewed interest in where our food comes from and under what circumstances it's raised or it's grown. As I mentioned, writers like Michael Pollan and The Omnivore's Dilemma have argued that there's a way for us to eat some meat ethically if it doesn't take place on industrial factory farms. Can you sum up that argument for us and why you find it wanting?
Sure. So the animal advocacy movement has actually had one great success, which is it's made the public at least a little bit uncomfortable with the term factory farming. You know, many people have a sense that what we do to animals in industrialized agriculture isn't pleasant, I guess is how I would put it. I mean, in my experience, actually very few people know the extent of the mass violence that we inflict on other beings in the food economy, the suffering that's involved, the sheer scale, global scale. Just they have no idea. But that said, people are, have become aware over the years of a problem, in terms of the ecological, ethical, and epidemiological consequences of raising billions of animals in intensive farming conditions. So part of what my book's about is it tracks a development about 20 years ago. It's been in the making for about that long, to kind of rebrand meat, eggs, and dairy and the whole animal economy, to rebrand it as a safe and benevolent institution. And so you saw this confluence of forces, economic and cultural forces, taking shape in the early 2000s especially, to sell the public on this idea that we can have our meat and our conscience too. We can raise animals perhaps in smaller farms. We can, quote, treat them humanely, kill them with, quote, unquote, compassion. And so it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for the environment because now we can do all this sustainably. It's a win for the animals because they're treated humanely. It's a win for the farmers who are struggling to survive, and it's a win for the consumer. So that's kind of what I call the myth of enlightened omnivorism. And so this figure of the enlightened omnivore developed. And Michael Pollan is a wonderful writer, but I think very bad on these issues, wrote a best-selling book in 2006 called The Omnivore's Dilemma, which kind of gathered together these disparate elements and cultural forces under one roof and created the intellectual scaffolding for the new meat, the new rebranded animal economy. And my book is really a takedown of this entire apparatus. At least that's my hope.
And you mentioned a moment ago that most people, most of us, don't have any conception of the scale of the animal economy, as you put it. So how extensive is it when you're talking about the production of fish and eggs and dairy and meat? On what scale does it take place?
Well, essentially, we've organized our civilization around mass violence. And that mass violence is everywhere on the face of the earth. We've turned the entirety of the earth into a kind of gulag archipelago of imprisonment and suffering. So when I talk to people about these issues, they really have no clue that we're killing about 80 billion land animals every year. Most of that figure comes from chickens, the killing of chickens. But that also includes cows and pigs and sheep and ducks and so on and so forth. You know, hundreds of different species are killed on land. And then in addition to that, we're talking about nearly 3 trillion marine animals are being killed every year at sea. There's something like 1 million motorized fishing vessels at sea at any time being, enabled through GPS and computer models and sonar on a quest to exterminate virtually all life in the oceans. So this system is global, and it's actually also the largest cultural artifact ever produced by our species. I mean, if you put together all the cities and roadways of our species, they would be dwarfed by the animal agriculture system alone. So I think it's really important to understand that capitalism includes the point of production, the conditions of production, and kind of mystifies what actually happens. I think that if people could really try to grasp with their minds the sheer scale of this, the violence, the suffering, they would understand why this is not a trivial issue. All of this violence, of course, is hidden. That's the nature of capitalist production, to hide the conditions of production, the origin point of production from the consumer. So there's a whole array of ideological mechanisms in place to obscure this violence from us. And this system, as I've said, is, it's undermining the conditions of life.
So you started touching on this, but I wonder if you could directly relate the killing of animals for food to the larger ecological crisis that, is unfolding all around us, including the climate crisis.
One thing, if you live as long as I have, you see changes in the way people talk about public issues. And in terms of the environment, for example, we've seen this lamentable narrowing of discourse around ecological crisis and collapse. So in, kind of popular media and so forth, the only thing you hear about as an issue or the thing you hear overwhelmingly about is global warming. Now, global warming, of course, is a huge catastrophe, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. So, but that's only one dimension of the environmental emergency. And an even bigger problem than global warming is the mass extinction crisis, which is to say all the birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, crustaceans, cephalopods, invertebrates, insects, and spiders, and so forth, they're all dying everywhere on the Earth. And this is the biggest mass species extinction event in 65 million years, and nobody talks about it. Pretty much nobody talks about it. Now, global warming is one of the causes of that. But especially in the mainstream environmental movement, what we're seeing is a failure to name the two structures or systems of power that are actually leading to the destruction of life on Earth. And one of them is capitalism, which, of course, the mainstream environmental movement never talks about. And the second is what I and others have called speciesism. It's a kind of, it's not a very pleasant sounding word. You can think of it as human supremacism. So basically, our whole way of organizing life around dominating, exploiting, and harming our neighbors, all the other beings of the earth. And these two together form what I call a double helix of that's encoding the destruction of terrestrial life. So the animal economy is today the most, other than capitalism itself, okay, the animal economy is the most destructive force on the Earth. It's worse than global warming, which, by the way, it is one of the leading contributors to. It's worse than everything else. I mean, if you look at the, for example, the Living Planet report that's issued every other year by the World Wildlife Fund and the London Zoological Society, if you look at the factors driving the ecological crisis globally, you would read that report carefully. Basically, animal agriculture and fishing is implicated in almost all of them. It's the scale of the thing and the fact that the animal system is, of course, being driven by capital accumulation that is leading to the cannibalization, really, of the Earth's resources. I mean, because other animals are simply treated as raw materials, there's no, there's consequently no respect for animal habitats, say living spaces. They're simply treated as proto-commodities in the system, and their living spaces are treated as raw materials for commodity production. So the combined effect of these two systems, speciesism and human supremacism, which are pretty much indistinguishable at the moment, is literally the collapse of the entire ecological order. And, you know, I could go into that, but that is the overview. And of course, in mainstream politics, you never hear about this. Neither of the two political parties ever talks about this. And even on the left itself, disappointingly, there's a refusal to recognize the depth of the crisis or the role that our treatment of other animals and enslavement of other animals plays in that crisis.
And we'll return to that point later as we go. I should say I'm speaking with critical theorist John Sambamatsu about his book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. John, there are going to be obviously a number of questions that will come to the minds of listeners and that I'm going to ask you. One of the most obvious is, haven't people been eating animals since time immemorial? And also, don't non-human animals kill other animals? Since we're animals, why should we be any different?
Yeah, thank you. When I talk to people about these issues, what's so striking to me is that it doesn't matter whether I'm talking to school children, college students, or full professors at elite universities. Everybody asks the same naive and fallacious kinds of questions, which tells me, I mean, it's just this kind of further confirmation that a system, any system of power and authority, has wrapped around it a kind of buffer of ideological positions, and to protect the core of the thing. So the two questions that you've asked me are kind of they're two of the more common questions that are asked of anyone who's a vegetarian or vegan. The first one is, well, humans have always been doing this, so what could be wrong with it, right? Now, of course, you know, humans have been killing each other probably forever, and also men have been dominating women probably forever. Or if not forever, you know, you really have to go back into the ancient past to find a time before there was patriarchy. But, you know, to make an argument that women should continue to be dominated by men, that men should have more prerogatives in society because that's just the way we've been doing it for a long time, is, of course, not a good argument. Those kinds of arguments that suggest that, well, you know, everyone does it, or it's been being done for a long time, those are actually arguments, I teach ethics, those are arguments of moral relativism. Moral relativism says that a practice is right if basically most people do it or if most people agree that it's right. And that's a very dangerous position. And then the second and related question is, well, what don't other animals eat animals? Therefore, it must be right. Again, now that's a similar argument. It's what we call an argument from nature. That because something we find is in nature, therefore it must be right. Okay, so there are a whole slew of problems with this. For one thing, not all animals do eat other animals. There are plenty of animals who are herbivores, including very large animals like horses and gorillas and so forth. So it's true, certainly, that predation is part of the ecological order. But what's different about humans as biological omnivores, that simply means we can eat pretty much everything. We can even eat one another, and we have. Right? Anthropophagy, cannibalism, has been part of numerous human cultures for thousands of years. But if I go and kill my neighbor and eat my neighbor, and the police come, I can't just say, well, you know, humans have been doing that for a long time, and plus I've evolved the ability to eat humans because I'm an omnivore, therefore, you know, I can't be held accountable. You know, we'd say that's silly to make that kind of argument. Now, unlike the lion who eats the gazelle, for example, humans don't have to eat gazelles or chickens or cows or any other conscious being. Because we're omnivores biologically, it simply means we can choose what to eat. And so we have a choice that the lions don't have. Why? Lions are obligate carnivores. They have to eat other animals to survive. That's not true of us, right? Now, if lions were having, you know, conversations among themselves about whether to eat animals, suppose that Jane Lion says to Joe Lion, "Hey, you know, I'm feeling bad about these gazelles. You know, I'm thinking about it, and there's a lot of suffering involved with those gazelles." And Joe Lion says, "Well, yeah, but they're so delicious." Well, if lions were engaging in that kind of moral debate, and they were still choosing to commit harm in lieu of some alternative, then we might be able to, you know, judge them ethically. But that's not the case for lions, and it is the case for us. So it's very easy for us to come up with really an endless, almost endless list of excuses for committing harm against other conscious, sophisticated beings. But they're not good arguments. You know, we can choose differently, and we should. We have a moral obligation, and I would argue a political obligation, to choose differently.
I'm wary of arguments based on what's natural or what's in our nature, but I'm going to ask you this one anyway. Some listeners may wonder about the dangers that pregnant people face if they followed an entirely vegan diet without supplementing with synthetic vitamins, especially vitamin B12. Doesn't that indicate some kind of inherent need for animal products, at least for one transient sector of society?
Well, I mean, you know, there are plenty of vegan women who've given birth to perfectly healthy, thriving children. I mean, it's not like we're in the dark here. There's a huge literature. Well, maybe I shouldn't say huge, but there's a very substantial, robust literature in the dietary sciences and nutrition studies published in the JAMA and The Lancet and so forth. In other words, the top medical journals showing that a vegan diet, a plant-based diet, is not only healthy, it confers numerous health advantages over an animal-based diet. I mean, this is simply not open to serious debate in terms of vegans having lower rates of heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes. They live longer, actually. I'm not familiar. I mean, I haven't read much. I'll be honest. I haven't read much about the specific case of pregnant people, but I know there's been research on that as well. Now, if you're asking, you know, well, should a nursing mother or a pregnant person, should they have to take vitamin B12, which, as you point out, is, you know, one thing that vegans don't normally get just eating what they eat. Usually they have to have B12 in something. Well, the public doesn't think twice about the fact that vitamin D, for example, is added to cow's milk. No one's up in arms about that. If it is the case that someone who's pregnant needs to have vitamin B12, like that is a prudent thing to do in any event as a vegan, but certainly if you're pregnant, you'd want to be sure about that. If that's a pretty small price to pay if that means we're able to eliminate violence against trillions, literally trillions, of our fellow beings. So that, to me, it seems like a red herring argument.
Well, let's step back and look at the emergence of the system that you've been describing in our more recent history. I mean, we can go back and there can be all sorts of arguments about the past, which are in many ways less relevant than understanding what has gotten to us to this point. You locate the transformation of the animal economy to the rise of capitalism. Not that people didn't eat animals, not that they didn't raise them for consumption before then. Can you trace the modern history of the animal economy, including how it relates to empire?
Sure. So I just want to, before I say that, I do want to make it clear that there have been critics of our violence against animals and our cruelty to them for literally thousands of years. So the problem does not merely arise with the emergence of the modern animal economy. But the modern animal economy is indeed an artifact of capitalist relations. One of the things that I find really frustrating is if you look at discourse, popular scientific writing about the environmental crisis and global warming, you know, the science writers often refer to industrialization as the problem. But industrialization, we know, is simply part of capitalist development. Now, what happened is the Europeans came to the Americas to colonize, take over the land, enslave the local inhabitants, to just simply just depopulate these continents through genocide and so forth. And at the same time, they did the same thing basically to all the other natural beings here. So there were widespread exterminationist campaigns against animals who could interfere with the emerging animal economy of the Americas, particularly the cattle industry. So that industry in particular, the cattle industry, develops in North America with white settlers. And there are some interesting works on the subject of how the extermination of local humans, indigenous peoples, was developed in parallel with the extermination of fur-bearing animals, then, you know, war of against animals at sea, the fishing industry, the whaling industry in particular. So both of these processes, which were closely intertwined, of controlling and decimating non-human populations and indigenous populations, these intertwined processes made possible the emergence of what we now think of as industrialized agriculture, so that by the end of the 19th century, you have the concentration of cows and chickens and pigs and sheep in Chicago, the Chicago yards, animals brought there en masse, millions of these animals shipped across the continent on the new rail system, and this automation of animal killing ends up becoming the first assembly line, or as people in the field call it, the first disassembly line, right? We think of Fordism and Henry Ford as the inventor of automation in the factory system, but actually it was the Chicago yards that innovated this. And a socialist named Upton Sinclair, of course, wrote a very famous book in 1906 called The Jungle, which was about the Chicago yards and the viciousness, the violence that was done both to immigrant workers, working class in Chicago, and to the animals who were caught up within the system. Upton Sinclair was himself a socialist, and he'd been sent on assignment to live with among the slaughterhouse workers during a strike to document what was going on there. And his book, The Jungle, was such a national scandal that the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, himself personally met with him. But, you know, that's just kind of the beginning of this moment when industrialized animal agriculture became the model for animal production around the world. And that production, of course, was subordinated to a scientific capitalist process, both of controlling labor and controlling the subjectivities of the captive animals within the system.
And how has that system intensified in the post-war period, and especially in the neoliberal era where so much of production has operated on a global scale?
Well, as you know, after World War II, we had the green, quote, Green Revolution, intensive application of intensive science techniques and genetics and scientific management of production on one side, and at the same time, a kind of an arms race within the advertising industry to find new ways of manipulating consumers on a mass level, right? So in the post-war period, we see the rise of animal consumption per capita. I think it's something like 400% between the end of World War II and, say, the 1970s. Don't quote me on that, but that's something like that. It's just an extraordinary expansion of the system. So the meat industry today is one of the most powerful industries, the animal industry is such one of the most powerful industries in the United States. I mean, it's worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, and hugely influential. So the neoliberal kind of slant that we see developing in society and in animal food economics from the 1970s on, and more, particularly in the 80s, 90s, stresses kind of the standard tropes of neoliberalism, which is consumer choice and consumer freedom, and you know these pesky ethicists are challenging your right to eat animals. So you have an industry that has worked very closely with consultants to rebrand, as I said, to rebrand these commodities as natural and sustainable and humane, and at the same time to demonize critics of the system. So at the same moment that we see, particularly in the early 2000s, like the imposition of austerity measures throughout the world, particularly Europe, but also in the U.S. and elsewhere, not to mention, in the developing South, at the same time you have a discourse of kind of punishment, of atomization, where supposed in the name of individual rights, certain social goods and public goods are to be stripped away. You find this resurgence of interest in homesteading and people raising animals and killing animals on their own, and that being kind of integrated within a post-Fordist economy of niche production and, again, as I said, individual liberties. So it's no accident that Joel Salatin, who's the poster child of Michael Pollan and the regenerative agriculture movement, Salatin is a Virginia-based farmer who runs this Polyface Farms, and he's highlighted in The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. And Salatin is no accident, as I was saying, that he was invited as a speaker to the Libertarian National Convention, that he's anti-immigrant and kind of racist and so forth. So interestingly, more and more, we in fact find links between the animal agriculture industry and the far right. We see this in Europe, we see this in the United States.
Well, let me ask you more about that. On the contemporary U.S. right, there's been, all sorts of celebration of meat eating, including promoting a diet of almost all meat, the carnivore diet, which I think nearly killed right-wing psychologist Jordan Peterson. Now, of course, we've seen fascist vegetarians and vegans, but I wanted to ask you how you understand this celebration of meat by parts of the U.S. right, which tends to overlap with this very masculinist celebration of the power of men over women.
Yeah. In 1990, Carol Adams wrote a book called The Sexual Politics of Meat, and she published that on the 20th anniversary of Kate Millett's groundbreaking feminist work, Sexual Politics, and I don't think that was an accident. The title, Sexual Politics of Meat, was, of course, meant to resonate with Millett's earlier book, and Adams points out in The Sexual Politics of Meat that for thousands of years, or at least centuries, you can look at particular cultures, and she concentrates especially on Euro-American culture, although not exclusively, you find this link between male supremacism, patriarchy, and domination over other animals. Even today, right, it's the men who fire up the grill in the back, right? A man who might not be caught dead in the kitchen. This is a stereotype, but there's still some truth to it, I'm afraid. Men who wouldn't be caught dead in the kitchen preparing, you know, a brunch, you know, they're happy to go out there and fire up the grill and put some ribs and so forth on. So that's maybe a trivial example, but it does show that we've historically, culturally, associated hunting, fishing, and so forth, killing of animals with male roles, masculine roles. And that continues to the present. Now, there are some interesting things going on in the culture around this. One is that precisely at the moment of this fascist backlash against women, this intense misogyny, you mentioned Jordan Peterson or, you know, Andrew Tate, whatever, Donald Trump, Hegseth, that this, at the moment that women's rights are being rolled back and that the culture industry is putting women and girls in its sights, we find this resurgence, a really insistent resurgence of that old trope that real men dominate animals. Real men dominate animals in the same way that real men dominate women. And this is, there's just so many examples of this. I mean, look at RFK Jr., you know, and the fact that he goes around putting dead bear cubs in Central Park, or Christy Noem, who boasted about murdering her puppy because the puppy was too rambunctious. She takes her dog into the back and shoots him. I mean, there's this weird stuff going on in the culture all about animals and meat. And I don't think it's an accident. I really think that if you strip back what the nature of domination is, social hierarchy is, you get down and down and down and down, and the ultimate foundation is our supremacy over other beings. This is even in Plato's Republic, when Socrates is talking about democracy as a form of government. He says that basically, well, if you really take democracy to its ultimate conclusion, then masters begin fearing their slaves, and men begin fearing equality or having equality with women, which is horrible, Socrates thinks. Children don't listen to their fathers, and even the animals nudge you out of the way. Horses on the street don't get out of your way. And Glaucon says, you're telling me my worst nightmare. So if you challenge that fundamental thing, just the very fact that humans on the planet are seen as lords over creation, then you begin to chip away at other forms of hierarchy, other forms of so-called natural domination. So it is not an accident that these things are all coming together at the exact same time, a kind of hyper-masculine militarism, you know, putting troops in the streets, shooting people. Tradition, you know, the trad wife is making a comeback, quote unquote, the traditional wife, women are being put back into traditional gender roles, and then hunkering down over a steak. It's part of the strategy, both of the far right and of the meat industry, to reiterate this set of norms.
John Sambamatsu is my guest. He's professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, author of The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You were speaking just a moment ago about the right, and one thing that certainly fed into the rise in popularity of the right was the COVID pandemic. And I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between the animal economy and pandemics, especially as right now we seem to be balancing on the precipice of another pandemic, that of avian flu.
One of the things that we think about when we think about veganism or the question of meat and so forth, a lot of people think, well, you know, humans, we just shouldn't, in a certain sense, can't sacrifice our own interests for them. You know, like if I give up eating meat, it's somehow seen as a sacrifice. Or if we as a society move away from the animal economy, well, maybe we'd be doing that for altruistic reasons, but it would be harming ourselves. It's actually the opposite, right? Because the animal economy, as I've said, is ripping up the ecosystem. but it's also creating new vectors of deadly disease for us. Most of the plagues and diseases that have ever afflicted our species come from our domestication, so-called domestication of animals in the economy, food economy. I don't have a list in front of me, but you can Google that. Everything from, you know, cholera to AIDS to, you know, E. coli and the Spanish flu, and now, of course, COVID itself. Either COVID came from a Chinese lab where they were experimenting on bats, or it came from a live animal market. But either way, it's derived from our exploitation of non-humans. 75% of all emerging diseases are zoonotic in origin. That means that we're getting them from other animals. Well, how does that happen? Because normally, you know, species do interact with one another, but they're not in immediate close proximity. Well, when we crowd animals together in a kind of prison system, a gulag, and we just treat them so horribly that they will die unless we force feed them antibiotics, which of course is what we do in the animal system. So that's, I think it's about 80% of antibiotic usage is to feed farmed animals. And that of course leads to the emergence of superbugs that are antibiotic resistant. But at any rate, we're simply creating new dangers for our own species. And you mentioned avian flu. This is something I've been very worried about for a long time, and the WHO has been worried about this for decades. I wrote something recently about this for Counterpunch, just the question of avian flu. Well, that's a whole discussion. But basically, you know, what's happening now is the Trump administration, you know, on the right, far right, is dismantling the public health system. It's dismantling our emergency management agencies, and it's covering up for big agriculture so that there's no tracking, virtually no tracking whatsoever, of this lethal virus that has become endemic in the world's largest prison population, which is to say American animal agriculture. So this virus is churning and churning and churning in cows and chickens and pigs and so forth. We've been lucky, very, very lucky so far, that it has not become a full-fledged pandemic. But virologists are quite concerned that we're on the verge, potentially, of a pandemic. And they'll tell you, if we get this pandemic that they've been predicting, and if the H5N1 has anything like its historic lethality, that would make it 100 times worse than COVID. Because historically, H5N1 has killed 50%. Of humans who've caught it, and 90% or more of pregnant women who've caught it. So that's what we're playing with here. And the thing is, it's just completely unnecessary. We could virtually eliminate that threat, not completely, because it's also in the wild animal population, by eliminating animal agriculture. But nobody will go there. No one wants to talk about that, because we think that we have a right to control the sexual reproduction, control the bodies, the labor of other species.
Well, John, let's talk more about the animals themselves. We've been talking about how raising animals to be slaughtered can be harmful to humans in various different ways. But I wonder if you could tell us about the research now that's been done on animals as beings. What do we know about how they think and feel?
That's such a great question, because, you know, there have been many books, many studies, films about how the animal economy is bad for us. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for human health and so forth. That is not the focus of my book. Focus is on these beings, the ones that we view as worthless. Now, people might get defensive about that and think, oh, no, I love animals. I don't see other animals as worthless. But, you know, honestly, since we're killing trillions of them every year, and if anyone even so much as raises their hand and lets out a squeak that says, I'm a vegan, there's that joke that, well, how do you know that there's a vegan in the room? The answer is because they'll tell you, right? So vegans have this reputation, and not incorrectly, of being proselytizers and trying to get people to wake up and think about these issues, right? But even if someone even raises their hand and says, I don't want to participate in this violence, people just jump on them and they get crazy about it. So there's this sense that this is a trivial issue. And what I try to explain in the book is that these beings who we dismiss as stupid, irrational, worthless beings are not that way. People who live with cats and dogs and really come to respect them, I mean, because not everybody treats cats and even cats and dogs well, right? But people who actually develop relationships with cats and dogs end up seeing them as members of the family. They don't think that they're human. I mean, that's just silly. No one thinks that. But they understand that they're complex individuals, that they have subjectivity, that they have memory, that they are capable of experiencing trauma. So Charles Darwin in 1871 in Descent of Man, who argued and gave evidence for the fact that humans are not special. I mean, we're special in some ways, I suppose, but there are enormous biological and evolutionary and ontological continuities between our species and other species. That was what was, of course, so upsetting to religionists, to Christians at the time that Darwin wrote Origin of Species and then the more incendiary Descent of Man, because he's saying, you know, we find intelligence, emotions, altruism in other species too. And people just went ballistic because they didn't want to believe that we could be related, even related to these inferior beings. Well, now, of course, we understand that we evolved alongside these other beings, and that the qualities of consciousness, of cognition, of emotion, that we think of as uniquely human are in no way uniquely human, in no way, right? So one thing I talk about in my book, for example, is empathy. And we think that only humans have empathy. Well, now we know that's not true. Humans were late to the game of empathy. There were empathetic beings on this planet millions of years before we got here. So this is not open to debate. There's just a superabundance of scientific research, field observation, as well as what I would call unethical laboratory experiments that demonstrate beyond any doubt that sophisticated cognition is not limited to humans. It's not limited to primates. It's distributed across the phylogenetic spectrum. I mean, there are fish who are better at some forms of reasoning than apes, great apes. Even insects, who we think of as just these little robots, little miniature robots or something, insects are not. They have, for example, ants, I think, insects in general, depends on the species, have been shown to exhibit something like 26 different kinds of learning. I could give many, many examples, and I do give many examples in the book. So one thing I'm trying to do in the book is to get people to perceive the other beings of our planet as having worth and as having lives that are worth respecting. And the science is completely on the side of that.
John, you've been talking about in this hour the ills of this system deeply embedded in capitalism, although preceding it, of an animal economy that would not be solved by factory farming, getting rid of factory farming, that is. And I wanted to ask you then, what about those people who think, okay, well, is there a vegetarian option here? If I stop eating meat, will that be sufficient? Tell us why vegetarianism by itself would not be enough.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I mean, when I became a vegetarian in college, that was in the 80s, so many, many years ago, I became a vegetarian. It didn't occur to me to become vegan. And when we think the word vegan, it has a lot of negative connotations. I mean, I don't even like the term vegan. You know, I see myself as an animal, as pursuing animal justice. I think that's how I would rather frame this. You know what I'm saying? So to produce cheese, for example, cows have to be impregnated, right? Forcibly impregnated. And then because of course cows produce milk for their young. I mean, in popular culture, we associate cows with milk, which is absolutely bizarre, right? Because otters and orcas and humans and other mammals, all mammals produce milk. There's nothing about cows. It's just that we have been learned to exploit their bodies for that purpose. So anyway, cows are impregnated, then they give birth. The the calf is in almost every case ripped from their sides, right, shortly after birth, causing trauma to the cow and to the calf. I mean, cows have great memories as we do. I mean, as all animals do, actually. And if given the opportunity to reunite with their offspring years later, they'll recognize them. So the cow's taken away, the baby's taken away, thrown into the veal industry, where they suffer horribly, et cetera, et cetera. I could just go into the details. Unfortunately, we want to think that we can have eggs and dairy and so forth and do and kind of maintain that. So I understand why people think that veganism is a big ask. I get that. But, you know, people can transition, maybe become vegetarian and then begin to phase out these other things. Because there's just an infinite variety of things to eat on this planet that are not animal. It's just simply a fact. I think there's something like 200,000 different edible plants on the Earth, 200,000, of which you and I probably eat, I don't know, 100, you know, on a routine basis, you know, eggplants and potatoes and wheat and so forth. So what caused me to become a vegan about 3 years after I became a vegetarian was kind of an aha moment where I realized, well, of course, cheese and eggs, it's part of the same system. I mean, all of those cows and all those chickens are going to be killed. They're going to be, you know, terrorized. And I think we know at an intuitive level, right, that taking advantage of another's vulnerability, right, by holding them captive or using violence against them, that's just exploitation. That's just wrong, right? That animals have bodies and they have a sense of their own integrity around their bodies. So when we violate those bodies or when we manipulate those bodies, it's always going to end up causing harm and suffering to those beings. But we have this myth, the humane myth, that we can have all of these products without causing violence against the beings that we tear this stuff away from. So again, I just think I do understand because I was there once myself, you know, that, oh, well, I'm just going to go vegetarian. And honestly, I want to encourage that. That's at least a step in the right direction. But ultimately, it's just not the solution. I mean, just on on ecological grounds alone, right, grazing cows for milk, for example, is one of the worst things you can do ecologically. It's a huge source of methane gas emissions. It's a huge waste of land. It's inefficient use of water resources, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, ultimately, we just need to move on, you know, animal agriculture, fishing, passé. Let's do something else. And by the way, we need to eliminate capital.
Let me end by asking you, since clearly you're not just talking about everyone just making an individual decision to not consume animal products, that if the industries that produce eggs and fish and meat and dairy were to be abolished, it would take more than just individual action. But you mentioned earlier that this has not been an issue taken up by the environmental movement by and large, and certainly has not been seen as one that is deeply connected to capitalism. So why do you think that is? And what kind of movement would you like to see to be able to abolish the animal economy?
Well, environmentalists have a hard enough time getting anyone to care about the destruction of our planet's ecology. And so they don't want to ally themselves with a movement of animal advocates a movement that's viewed negatively because of the animus that people have towards anyone who declines to participate in the system. So it's as simple as that. I mean, there's a movie, I actually haven't seen it, to be honest, but it's called Cowspiracy, which covers this and how the mainstream environmental movement has seen the raising and killing of animals as a kind of third rail issue. And what's so weird about that is that actually the animal agriculture system and the fisheries industry are together the most destructive force on the earth, ecologically speaking. Now, I say that, you know, in awareness that capitalism can also capitalism is also doing that. But the two systems are so entwined together that you can't really separate them anymore. So that the food system, it's a strange absence that we see in environmental discourse. But I think it's because, you know, no one wants to confront this issue, including environmentalists, who most of whom continue to participate themselves personally in the system. So there's an ideological, existential, cultural attachment to the practices of domination over other species that we find, you know, in every sphere and every institution in society, and the environmental movement is no different.
John Sambamatsu, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sasha. It was a delight to be with you again.
I've been speaking with John Sambamatsu, author of The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. He's professor of philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, also the author of The Postmodern Prince. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.